one of the fascinating things I found out that this teacher was telling me was they like to take children when they're 5, 6, 7 years old because their brains are capable of being manipulated.
Artie Six Killer Clark, more encounters with star people. Urban American Indians tell their stories. It's nice to know that this isn't just area specific. This is happening all over, and you're getting some stories I think people really want to hear. So thank you.
Well, thank you. The stories are representative of people from all over the country. You know, this book particularly, I wanted to show people that 78% of American Indians live off of reservations. And my first book dealt solely with people who are residents of a reservation. And this book concentrates on American Indians who are not living on reservations. And like I said, there's 78% of us out there that live in small towns and rural areas and cities. And so I wanted I'd never consciously sat down and said, okay, what are there differences and similarities between the reservation people and the non-reservation people? And so that's what I attempted to do, to just present a variety of stories along many themes that are found in UFO literature, you know, stories of giants, stories of lizard people, stories of UFO abduction. And so I that's what I attempted to do, and I think I did.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of variety. And so I'm going to start with Chapter 18, I'm No Longer a Skeptic. And this is Jonathan, who moved to Alaska.
Jonathan, you know, he was actually a student of mine. I served as a chair of his master's committee. He moved to Alaska. I helped him get the job up there. He was having trouble getting a teaching job because he was an older than average student. People were looking for young people that were entering the field. And there was a resignation up there, and I got a call from a superintendent asking me about him. And so he was thrilled to be going up there. And in the summer, he decided to buy a used trailer and take off and see parts of Alaska. And he began to tell me the story of how he was camped in this campground one night. And all of a sudden, the outside of the place just lit up like it was daylight. And he said he thought it was a helicopter, but there wasn't any sound. And he said he walked toward the light for a better look, and he said he made out the silhouette of a large cylinder-shaped object above the tree line. And he said it was just hovering there. There was no sound, no wind, nothing. And then a searchlight fell upon his trailer and stayed there. And he said, by this time, I assumed they knew about me. And he said that he watched them. He had watched them siphon water out of the lake. He was camped near a lake. And he said, so I'm sure my presence there was a surprise to them because they weren't expecting to see anybody there. It wasn't an organized campground or anything. And he said that he had gone into the trees and kind of hidden himself and watched them take this water. And he said once they found him, though, they didn't move. And he said within minutes, a man came out of the light, and he called him a man. He said, but he was at least 7.5 feet tall. And he asked me to come with him. And he said, I don't remember how I got on board. But he said all the men on the ship were 7 feet tall or more. He said they looked human. They had a human form, but they were different, not just in height, but in difference of appearance. And when I asked him to explain, he said, well, their skin was kind of spongy. He said, when I touched them, they felt like their skin felt like sponge, and my fingers left an imprint. But then when I let it go, it restored itself. And he said they had no hair on their heads, and they had huge round eyes, not slanted eyes like you see in the movies, and they had no ears. And they had no lips, although there was a small opening. And he said they had strange openings on their neck that reminded him of fish gills. And I asked him how they communicated, and he said, well, they didn't communicate much, but they somehow made they made me feel at peace, and I wanted to know where they're from, and they simply pointed toward the ceiling. And I asked him if they performed any experiments on him, and he said, well, I don't remember. But he said, I found myself outside my trailer at 6 a.m., and he said, but what I noticed was a red bump on my upper arm. He said, I don't know how I got it, but I noticed it when I brushed up against the trailer door because it hurt. And then he took off his shirt, and he showed me the red bump. It was almost like a boil. He said, this is the place this bump appeared, and it's gone down some, but the imprint is still there. And he said, you know, I never believed in all this stuff. I just thought it was nonsense, and people were making up stories. But he said, the truth of the matter is, I'm no longer a skeptic. I'm a believer.
Well, and the thing about this story is that he says that there was another reason for telling you, and there was a young boy, and this is where
right.
It's even
you know,
better.
I had taken a group of students, graduate students with me. I was doing some testing of an entire school population on the reservation about there had been a number of suicides. And what we were looking at were to discover if there were any suicidal tendencies. And I had trained a group of graduate students to go with me. And we were interviewing each student individually. This little boy, one of the questions that we ask is, if you could be someplace else, where would it be? And this little boy told him that he would go with the people to another planet. And he said, the little boy was so serious. He said that the little boy said, I felt so good there. He said he wanted the aliens to come back for him because he said there he was at peace. And he said the little boy kept talking about space travel and the peace he felt when he traveled with the aliens. And I recalled him telling me this story because what he said to me was, you know, I really, when he was telling me about this little boy, he said, you know, this child has a tremendous creativity. And he said, I just hope the school district doesn't stifle that. And he has opportunities to express himself. And, of course, then, you know, when this happened to him, he's thinking of Chaske and he's saying to me, you know, I think he told me the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think what I thought was just fantasy was the truth, that this little boy was a traveler. And he said, I would love, he said, by now he would be, you know, a teenager. You know, I'd love to talk to him. And but I could never find him. I went, when I was in the school district, I asked the principal about him. She found the records of him when he was a third grader. His family had moved, and there was no record. All it showed is that he had moved to Arizona, and so nobody knew where he was from then. But, you know, if I ever run across Chaske, I'm sure going to ask him. I mean, it's an amazing story, you know.
Yes. Yeah, and that was, you know, that's why I wanted to start with that. I'm no longer a skeptic. There's another story in there where a young woman that you keep track of, the woman who's afraid, well, the woman and her daughter. The daughter has been abducted or is supposedly going with other young women to possibly repopulate another planet.
She was a woman I had worked with over the years and, you know, and who knew her. And she had grown up on a reservation. She was working as a social worker in an Indian social program in Phoenix. And when I met her, I was giving a speech at a women's group on my book, Sisters in the Blood. And I had an elder across the table ask me if I was still collecting UFO stories. And when I told her yes, I was, she said, I want you to meet someone. And when this lady, you know, heard what I had said, when Mary heard what I told her, she said, when you have some time, I have a story too. Well, when I went to her office to meet her for lunch, and she said, I'm going to tell you a story, and I don't think you're going to believe it. I wouldn't believe it myself if somebody told it to me, but I swear to you, she said, it's true.
Artie Sixkiller Clark. Sixkiller.com is the website.
Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio.
The next thing I know, I'm on board a spacecraft, and I don't know how I got there. She has her daughter with her, and she says, but there's voices telling me that she doesn't belong to me. And she says, I keep saying that, you know, this isn't true, that she belongs to me.
More encounters with star people. Urban Americans, Indians tell their stories.
She said, I'm going to tell you a story, and I don't think you're going to believe it. I wouldn't believe it myself if somebody told it to me, but I swear to you, she said, it's true. She said, it has consumed me since my daughter, Sherry, was an infant. And so she goes on and she talks about how 12 years ago, she and her daughter lived on the outskirts of the city, and her husband had built a house for them in a small rural development outside Phoenix. And she said, nothing pretentious, just a small house for the three of us. Her husband was killed before their daughter was born by a drunk driver. And so she said, you know, all of her friends wanted her to move into town and everything, but she wouldn't do it because her husband had built this house. And she said, one evening when I was driving home, she said it was winter, and I had to stop and pick up dinner and Sherry from a Montessori school. And she said, at the time, she was only 2 years old. And she said, I was on the road headed home when I saw a stationary light up ahead near the highway. And she said, it was low to the ground, but for some reason I got in my head that it was a plane from the airbase. And she said, then as I got closer, I realized it wasn't a plane because this light was motionless. And she said, it never occurred to me that it was a UFO. And she said, I'm driving along, and suddenly this blinding light disappeared, but at the same time, my headlights went out, the dashboard lights faded, and the car stopped. She said, fortunately, I was able to guide the car to the side of the road before the headlights went out, and she said, I got out of the car, I unstrapped Sherry from the car seat and decided to walk home because I was no more than a mile from the house. And she said, the night was very clear, the moon was bright, and I figured I could make it on my own. And I said, but at this point, do you know there's a UFO? And she says, no, I just think I'm having a streak of bad luck, and I've got to get this baby home. So she said, I decided that instead of walking down the highway, I would cut through the neighbor's field. She said, I thought I would cut a quarter of a mile off of my walk. And she said that all of a sudden, a light search the ground around her, and when it fell upon them, it stopped. And she said, the next thing I know, I'm on board a spacecraft, and I don't know how I got there. She has her daughter with her, and she says, but there's voices telling me that she doesn't belong to me. And she says, I keep saying that, you know, this isn't true, that she belongs to me. And I said, well, did you see anybody? Did you see anything? She said, only fleeting glimpses, nothing more. She said, they returned me to Earth and placed me in front of my door with Sherry in my arms. And she said, and you aren't going to believe this, my car, it was parked in the driveway. And she says, I know this sounds impossible, but it's true. And she said, they told me, eventually they ended up telling her that they were going to take Sherry, that Sherry did not belong to her. And she said that they indicated to her that because she had been unable to have children, she and her husband had been trying for quite some time, that they had intervened and they had helped her get pregnant with her daughter. And even though her husband was the biological father, they had also implanted in her, in Sherry, a part of their DNA. And she said that they told her that when Sherry reached a certain age, they were going to take her. And she said, I wouldn't be able to live without my baby. You know, Sherry is all I have. So I kept in touch with her over the next few years. And the last time I saw her, I had gone there, and she had told me that Sherry had already met with other girls. Sherry was 16, she said. When I told her I was coming to Phoenix the following week, I could have sworn she thought my visit was an inconvenience because we had always been, you know, we had developed a close friendship. When I get there, she's lost all this weight because supposedly the star people told her to. She bounced around the kitchen like a teenager, and she poured me a glass of wine, and then she said, I'm going to miss wine. And I said, what? do you mean? And she says, well, they said I can go too. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, 4 months ago, they told me to prepare myself. And she said, I had to give up all meat. I could only eat vegetables and fruit because that's what they have. And she said, we're going, there'll be no meat. We will live on fruits and vegetables. And she told me that it was an experiment, that the planet was being inhabited by females. And all of these girl babies around the world were born near the same time, and they had all been born under the same conditions, and they had been selected. But what they had discovered is that the mothers were so distressed, and the children were so distressed of leaving their mothers, they gave the mothers the option of going with them. And if there was a grandmother and no other relatives, the grandmother could also go. And she told me that she was preparing to leave. She had already signed over her home to a nonprofit agency there that helped Indian girls. And she said, I'm leaving. And she said, and don't ask me if you can come and see me go, because I'll be gone. And when I went back there a couple of months later, she wasn't there. I looked for her. I stayed in contact with her for over 2 months, and then after that, her phone was no longer in service. When I went back to Phoenix, I went to her old office. They said, no, she quit, and we don't know where she went. I contacted people throughout the area, even went to Pearl, who was her mother, her reservation, and asked in the village where she lived if they knew where she was. Nobody, and I have never been able to find her.
Yeah, she had a daughter, and then her mother, so that would be the three of them all went?
Right.
See, that's just mind-boggling.
I know. But I do believe she was, it's the truth. What happened to her?
Well, there was also a reason they didn't take the boys. I thought that was fascinating, too.
You know, they wanted to see if a planet inhabited by women would be non-aggressive and that people could get along, you know, and felt that women were just as capable of running a society as men. And I said, well, you know, how are they going to perpetuate this? And she said, well, the babies will be born. You don't need a man for babies to be born. And I said, well, what if baby boys are born? She said, they have the method to make sure that no baby boys are born.
Yeah, and this is science fiction. I mean, this is, you know, you can read a science fiction story about that. But that's what I thought was so fascinating, because there's another story in your book when you're talking about masters of deception.
Right.
And this is a different story. But when, you know, this is a story that this woman was given about her daughter, and her daughter seemed to express no fear. She was looking forward to it. She was on board.
Oh, yeah. I mean, her daughter had already met with other girls who were in similar situations, you know, and was willing to make that journey, and apparently had been prepared for it, because they indicated that they had done something to this child that was in her womb, even though she was the mother, and her husband was the father, but they had within her womb made it possible for her to have this child to begin with, and then had part of their being into this fetus.
Okay, and these are the stories that people really find very, I guess, they're so out of our realm of experience, that when you're asking someone to say, yes, they're here, they're conducting all sorts of different kinds of research, and then they're preparing people. Don't we miss people when they're gone? This is like they fall through the cracks, and all of a sudden it's like they never existed, or they didn't, they're lost. How does this happen?
Well, if you think of how many missing people there are every year in this country, what is it, something like 20,000, or I don't know, it's an astronomical number. I used to know what that number was, but I think they say that out of the 100,000 people that go missing, 50% of them you can chalk up to either being murdered or committing suicide, or or runaways or something of that nature. But the other 50%, they have no idea what happened to them.
Artie Six Killer Clark. She has an incredible archive full of stories from Native Americans, American Indians, about contact with UFOs. Sixkiller.com is the website. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio.
You said you were traveling the back roads of Montana following up on stories, and he said, I thought you'd surely heard about some UFO stories. And he said, you know, this is the place where the old ones come and go. He said, this is the place where you can travel the Universal Highway.
More encounters with star people. Urban American Indians tell their stories. Artie Six Killer Clark, you can check out her website at sixkiller.com. You had me hook, line, and sinker. What was this like meeting Tom?
I had heard about this place from a Blackfeet graduate student of mine who told me there's a place called Writing on the Stone in Alberta, Canada. It's a provincial park, actually, now. There are pictographs and petroglyphs of Native people past that are both ceremonial and biographical in nature on rocks in this park. And he said that the unique thing about it is known there is a portal there where you can step into another time or another place. And he said that there are many accounts of people who have done that. I decided one day that I had never been up there and I was going to go. I mean, if this is in my back door, why not go check it out? The scenery as you're making that drive up toward Alberta is just magnificent. And one point I pulled off the road and I walked several feet off the highway to take some photographs. And as I was taking a photograph of an Indian paintbrush, it's a flower, a voice said to me, my grandmother used to collect those flowers. He said, she put them in salads. And he said, but you can only eat the flowers because the roots and the leaves are toxic. And I turned around and there stood this very tall, broad-shouldered, muscular man. He had two long black braids that hung down his middle of his chest. And I was fairly shocked. I wasn't expecting anybody to be there. And I told him so. And I said, you know, he said, well, I'm camping here. He says, my pickup is over there. He said, you're welcome, you know, to stay and join me. He offered me a cup of coffee. And eventually, I did agree to stay and visit with him. And as he began to talk, I started to walk away. I told him where I was going and what I was doing. And he said, there are not very many people who travel this way, he said. And so I seldom ever see people. As I started to leave, he asked me if I believed in UFOs, which just stopped me dead in my tracks. And I said, well, why are you asking that? And he said, well, you said you were traveling the back roads of Montana following up on stories. And he said, I thought you'd surely heard about some UFO stories. And he said, you know, this is the place where the old ones come and go. He said, this is the place where you can travel the Universal Highway. Well, of course, you know, I had to find out what the Universal Highway was.
Yeah, I did too.
And so I actually ended up camping out with, you know, at his campsite. He was turned out to be probably one of the gentlest souls I've ever met and one of the nicest men I've ever met. And he began to tell me stories about how you could, you know, when the portal opens, you could walk inside and you could think of where you want to go and you could be there. He said there are these portals all over the world. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I met a man in Maui who told me that there was a portal along this waterfall. And I said, I camped out there for days and it never did happen. And he said, well, they do happen. He said they're in Mexico, Bolivia, Alaska. There's one in Chinle, Arizona. There's one in the Black Hills. He said there's one near Livingston, Montana. And he started going through all this, and he said, in fact, he had learned about this from his grandfather. But he said his first experience had been as an adult was when he was in Iraq. His platoon or whatever it is was sent into this city because they had heard that Saddam was hiding out in this particular city. And they were sent in there, and when they got there, he said it was like an ambush. He said, we came under attack, and there were sharpshooters on buildings shooting at us. There were people hiding behind buildings. And he said, I was looking for cover, and I stumbled into this vacant building. And he said, all of a sudden, a tunnel opened up. an entity appeared there and welcomed me to follow him. And I went down this long tunnel, and there was a spacecraft, and I was offered the opportunity to go with them. And when I told them that I couldn't go because that would be desertion and that I owed it to my fellow soldiers to stay with them and to try to help them, they couldn't understand that kind of loyalty. But then they told him they would be back the next day if he changed his mind. And I said, well, did you? And he said, oh, I was tempted. He said it was so cool inside there, and the temperatures outside were like 130 degrees. And he said he had had the opportunity to go other times since he had been home. And he said, sometimes the star travelers come to me. And he talked about one star traveler who had come to this very campsite and who had traveled around Wyoming and North and South Dakota and Montana with him to all different Indian reservations and participated in ceremonies and different things. So Tom was, without a doubt, one of the most unusual characters. We're still in touch. He stops by and when he's passing through and has dinner with my husband and me. And I ask him, can you tell me how I would know if I met a star traveler? And he said, well, have you ever met a person who was kind and selfless and who was at peace with himself? And I said, well, I think I've met a few. And he said, well, you probably met a star traveler. I thought about that a long time, and I thought, well, the one person I know that fits that description was Tom. So I'm still trying to decide if he's one of them.
About Tom. He kind of fits that description. And then when I matched it with the Masters of Deception, only in a good way, because the other story about this was that they can appear any way you want. If whoever you are, they can mirror you, and you can't tell
the
difference.
You know, they can make a man think he's with a beautiful woman. They can make you think that you're in this beautiful place. They can implant ideas. One of the fascinating things I found out that this teacher was telling me was they like to take children when they're 5, 6, 7 years old because their brains are capable of being manipulated. And then they can continue to abduct them over the years. Say they're more likely to, if they abduct them when they're young, to be able to create these kinds of images. They were telling her that there are different things in the human brain, and certain elements make the human brain more compliant. And people who have that are the best participants. They're the best ones for them to, the best victims, because they don't remember what happened to them, and they can make them think, you know, anything. And where those that are absent this element in the brain remember their encounters and are more likely to speak out about it and to try to
resist,
warn others about it.
Telepathy, that's spot on. When they're talking about, you don't have to have some kind of a vocal connection with them. It's an implant where you have this automatic, instantaneous, there's the thought and you're receiving it. It's like, whoa, you're in my head.
The interesting thing about that is I've talked with elders who are in their late 80s and 90s and who tell me the same thing as people who are 25 year olds, that they get in their head and they tell them things, you know, so that the communication. And then I had an interview with a man who claimed that he had fathered 6 alien children and had met them and had been on the planet of their mother, and who said only children who were hybrids could speak. Only children who had either an earth mother or an earth father could speak. That the aliens themselves could not speak.
More encounters with star people.
Artie Sixkiller Clark. Sixkiller.com is the website. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Artie Sixkiller Clark.
I loved Sebastian. He finds himself in battle, in a foreign war, and he's with Antonio. And Antonio is this little Italian guy from New York City who says that, you know, he hangs on to him because he says, if I survive this war, it will be because of Sebastian, you know, this American Indian fighter, you know, from the time they were enlisted or in the military until this one night they are hiding out in this abandoned church that had been bombed. and they had taken refuge there, and the bombs are falling all around them, and suddenly this UFO flies over this bombed out church, and Sebastian sees it. The last thing he hears is Antonio calling his name, and when he turns around, Antonio is gone. He looked and looked and looked for Antonio, and Antonio is nowhere. He gets back home. He's going to the reservation, and he is himself abducted. And he says the aliens told him they had taken Antonio, that Antonio was taken because he would never have survived the war, and they knew he would. And so they took Antonio because they knew his fate and that he was with them and had been with them, and he was safe. And it was only then that he was able to reconcile his feelings, because all this time he was feeling that he had let Antonio down. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because he said that when they kidnapped him, they took him in his little old pickup that he had bought when he got out of the army. And he said, every time I get in that pickup, they abduct me. And he says, it's okay if you don't care about what your destination is, because you never know where you're going to end up. And he was, I mean, he was such a lovable, wonderful old man that had these stories to tell about his abduction. And then Bo, down in the Four Corners area of New Mexico and Arizona and that area, telling me about encountering these aliens. There were two different types on this ship, and they were parked at a, park the right word, they landed, I should say. Parked, I don't know, well, I guess you park it. But they were going into an abandoned copper mine, and these little aliens, the small ones, were retrieving samples, it looked like to him, of ore and bringing them out, and the tall ones were examining them and going through them, and then they would discard the ones they didn't want and they would keep the ones they did want. So he saw that as a very threatening event and felt that if they're wanting our resources.
Yeah, we can't protect that.
Yeah, there's just so many different stories in the book about different encounters, and that was my mission. I wanted to really show people the variety of things that are happening out there, because so often many books just deal with one subject, whether it's abduction or different kinds of sightings or stories about Bigfoot or stories about the little people or something like that. And I wanted to provide my readers with an opportunity to see the variety of experiences and the variety of craft, the variety of creatures that are visiting Earth, and so that's what I set out to do.
I think you've done that. And I'm probably sure there's more stories you didn't have enough room to put in this book.
Yes.
Yay.
There's so many.
Yay.
There's so many stories. The interesting thing of it is, I've gotten such a reputation of collecting these stories that, I'll have people approach me. The first thing they'll say to me is, I'm not an Indian, but I got a story to tell. And I'll say, okay, well, let's go someplace where we can talk. And I've collected so many stories, literally a couple hundred stories from people who are non-Indian, and they're very similar in nature. At least the theme is similar in nature. And I'm just amazed at the number of people who do have encounters. Right after my first book came out, I was at a barbecue, and there were 10 people there. And out of the 10 people, 6 of them spoke about having encounters. 2 were medical doctors. One was a geologist that he traveled the world looking for oil, and he had had 3 experiences in South America. One was a retired school teacher from Colorado. There were a couple of graduate students, and then my next door neighbor. And out of the 10 people there, that's 60%. And all of these people were basically strangers, We had this little community gathering, my neighbor and I, just welcoming new people into their summer houses, and invited these people over. And this was the makeup of this group. If that's happening to that many people, and most people just keep it a secret.
There's more people talking about it now, which is why I love talking with you, because it gets the word out and it gets people to be at least more acclimatized to this kind of conversation and knowing that they're not as weird as they think they might be.
That's right. You look at almost all of the people that I talk to have never ever told these stories. They've kept it a secret. I was on Coast to Coast, and George Norrie and I was talking about this. And when I got off the phone, I was just bombarded with emails from people telling me that they had had an experience that I never told anyone. I had probably a dozen people that went into extensive details about what happened to them.
There's your next book?
Yeah. I talked to my publisher about writing a book about non-Indians, and they seemed to think that the public might not be as interested in the stories from non-Indians as they are for Indians. But, I've had some fascinating stories told to me.
All the stories give us ways of connecting elements that are important for us in terms of finding them valid. I went to the doctor and told him I was doing a show and this is UFOs were going to be part of it. And he proceeded to tell me, because he grew up in Nebraska, of two encounters with UFOs in Nebraska.
You know, I got a letter the other day from a doctor, and it was interesting because he told me that in 1912, his mother, now think of this, 1912, his mother had a UFO encounter. Now, that's long before Roswell and any of this stuff, and he described the ship. There were other witnesses, and you know, during the early 1900s, there was a whole wave of UFO sightings across America. And here you have, you know, this doctor saying, you know, here I am, my mother telling me about this, you know, as a little boy of what happened to her in 1912.
In terms of the stories, I think you've got little jewels and you just haven't unleashed the whole treasure chest just yet.
You know, when I started out, I had almost 1,000 stories. And of course, along the way, I've collected another 500. So I have a lot of stories that are untold, and of course, not all of them anybody will ever see. There's too much of a chance that somebody could identify somebody. And I do promise anonymity for the people, and I do create fake names and disguise the places. You know, I might say, well, this took place in New Mexico, when in fact it may have taken place in Arizona or Utah, you know. But I do try to do that because I don't want the people, they have such a fear of somebody chasing them down.
One of the positive stories that I really liked was the protectors. And there are people here who protect the visitors for good cause.
This family has been doing this for well over a century. They live in a very remote area, and the grandfather protected them and allowed them to come onto his land to rest, to get water. The same thing with his father and now him, and then he's passing that tradition on to his nephew because he says that we have that responsibility.
If you found one of those portals, would you go through it?
Oh, I would in a minute. Would you?
I don't know, because I thought, how would I get back?
Then I would trust, you know, if I were with Tom, he'd get me back.
Yeah, I trust Tom too. Tom is our guy.
I don't know if I go in it by myself, but I would certainly, I probably would. I'm so curious. Yeah.
If Tom was there, you bet. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or Bo, or some of the other ones that are in the book, you know.
Yeah.
Or
okay.
The Watcher, Jim Gray Dog, down in Death Valley. I mean, he was an amazing man. Did you read that chapter?
I did, but we're going to have to go because we're out of time.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully
your readers will pick up the book at Amazon and read these fantastic stories of people who have had encounters. Maybe it'll help them, you know, because a lot of people tell me, oh, this story really helped me.
An update on the numbers. Artie now has over 4,000 accounts from Native Americans, American Indians, on their stories about UFO contact that hopefully will see the light of day at some point. One way or the other, she has an incredible archive. Sixkiller.com is the website. I'll follow up with a blog post, wendyscoffeehouse.com. Thanks for listening. Stay curious.